This is Thinking in Public, a program dedicated to intelligent conversation about frontline theological and cultural issues with the people who are shaping them. I'm Albert Mogul, your host and president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. Christopher Cox is now senior scholar in residence at the University of California, Irvine. He received his undergraduate degree from the University of Southern California and then both his MBA and law degree from Harvard University, where he served as an editor of the Harvard Law Review. He worked as a clerk at the U.S. Court of Appeals, a lecturer at the Harvard Business School. He's been a partner in law practice and was senior associate counsel to President Ronald Reagan. From 1989 to 2005, he served as a member of the U.S. House of Representatives for the state of California, where he chaired many committees committed to national security. In 2005, he was appointed by President George W. Bush as chairman of the Security and Exchange Commission. He held that role until 2009. It is his newly published book, Woodrow Wilson, The Light Withdrawn, that is the topic of our conversation today. Christopher Cox, welcome to Thinking in Public.
Well, I'm happy to join you.
I have to tell you that I have anticipated your book for a long time and read it with great pleasure. One of the questions that comes to my mind is why this book wasn't written a long time ago. The materials were all there, and yet they waited for you to pick this up. And I think that's a story unto itself.
It really is. It, of course, revolves around how women ultimately got the vote in the United States of America across the country, not just in a few states, and why it took so long. And it's very closely connected to racial politics. Both of those subjects were either soft-pedaled or ignored for about a century of Wilson biographies. The most recent biographies of Woodrow Wilson, the good ones, the full ones, have indeed touched on these issues, but none of it has been treated as central to the Wilson story. And that's a shame because looking back at the 20th century and the great events of the 20th century, I think it's pretty clear in hindsight that this enormous change, bringing half of the population into the voting booth, this was a great step forward for democracy, one of the great events of our country, and yet it was overlooked. At the millennium, Gallup actually did a poll, and they asked people, what were the most important events of the 20th century? And over two-thirds said women getting the vote. It finished ahead of World War I and the collapse of the Soviet Union, the man on the moon, the fall of the Berlin Wall, and so on. Only World War II beat it out. So with the long lens of history, it's very important for us to look at how this happened, why it happened, and most importantly, why it took so long.
Yeah, I guess the issue for me is the centrality of Woodrow Wilson to all the narratives that you just touched on, including racism, including his opposition to women's suffrage. But even more so, I think, the question to me about Woodrow Wilson in history, I took the time in preparation for this conversation to go back and look at several of the lists of, the greatest presidents in the United States. And in almost every one of those lists, Woodrow Wilson's in the top 10. And he was considered to have such massive stature that, even you have the Woodrow Center for scholarship Woodrow Wilson School for many years at Princeton, where he had been president. And you have all this adulation of Woodrow Wilson. He's treated as a figure who was prophetic in the early 20th century, if only America had listened to him. Mr. Cox, I started reading more closely about Woodrow Wilson when I was a very young man. And what I discovered is someone who was, frankly, shocking at almost every level.
Yeah, the Woodrow Wilson of myth and the Woodrow Wilson of all of the monuments and the movies and so on is what we all grew up with, or at least those of us who were, in my case, baby boomers or older. There's no question that there was a lot of momentum in the 20th century to create, essentially a Mount Rushmore image for Woodrow Wilson. And that was possible in major respect because he led the nation in World War I, and because government propaganda at the time. There was an entire propaganda agency that was formed uniquely under the Wilson administration to promote his image, not just in the United States, but in Europe. And that carried then over into biographies that were written by Wilson acolytes, people who had been, you know, his associates, his supporters, his intimates, and political favorites. And then that sort of flooded the zone. There were not critical looks at Woodrow Wilson at all for most of the 20th century, with a notorious exception of one written by Sigmund Freud, or co-authored by Sigmund Freud, who, of course, had an axe to grind because his native country was on the losing side of the war.
Well, you know, here's how I come to the question. I'm interested in massive intellectual and cultural shifts in history. And I think in retrospect, the shift that came with progressivism in the late 19th and early 20th centuries has been underestimated. I think most people, most conservatives in the United States think of kind of a decline and fall. And they would think of, say, the Roosevelt administration as the point at which everything began to fall. I really date it with the Wilson administration in terms of Wilson's quite blatant disregard for the Constitution, his advocacy for the administrative state, which he saw in Bismarck's Germany, his understanding of the frankly what he saw the limitations of the American constitutional order, and his intention to eclipse that order. I mean, I don't think the average American has a clue that Woodrow Wilson, long before he became president of the United States, said that the U.S. Constitution was already an outdated document.
Yes, that's how he began his academic life, starting even when he was a senior at the College of New Jersey. He wrote a short paper aggrandizing the British system in which the legislative branch is, you know, essentially melded with the executive, and we have the prime minister and his party controlling what goes on in the House of Commons. This, he thought, was a much better approach, and he thought of a way, rough justice way, to sort of graft that onto the U.S. system so that the president would be able to write laws, the president's cabinet members would serve as chairman of committees in Congress, and so on. It would have made the legislative branch very subservient to the executive, and it would have, you know, just tossed out the checks and balances that are the essence of the U.S. system, which is much more focused on limited government. If you want unlimited government, then you might very well appreciate what Woodrow Wilson had in mind. You mentioned FDR, and of course, FDR cut his teeth in the Wilson administration. He was Assistant Secretary, Secretary of the Navy. He and his wife traveled with the Wilsons on the USS George Washington to the Paris Peace Conference, and they were, you know, quite close. So FDR had Woodrow Wilson, who was then, you know, this larger than life figure, particularly after his tragic death, as his model. And so I think you're right that the fountainhead of a lot of what happened during the Roosevelt administration, that is the Franklin D. Roosevelt administration, you know, had its wellspring in the Wilson years.
A little footnote that I enjoy from that trip, by the way, is that that was the occasion in which a much younger Franklin Delano Roosevelt met Winston Churchill. And Roosevelt was very upset when Churchill, decades later, did not remember that meeting. Turned out that Roosevelt was in a very different position at that point, but so was Churchill.
Yes, and Churchill, of course, wrote about his impressions of Woodrow Wilson as well. And what he noted about Wilson was that Wilson was extraordinarily accommodating to all of the European demands that were made on him as a negotiator. He was personally negotiating at the Paris Peace Conference, but that when he returned to the United States, he would not give an inch the United States Senate.
I want to get to that, but I'd like to take us back to Woodrow Wilson as a boy, who, of course, was not known as Woodrow Wilson as a boy, but rather as Thomas or Tommy. And I think it's a part of this, of the story, that's just integral. I think you tell this very well. This is a boy who was very much a part of the South, very much a part of the South in a Southern Presbyterian household, that had a very different understanding of American history than Wilson would later articulate. But then again, Wilson would take much of that right into the White House and, frankly, all the way through his life to his grave.
Indeed. You've started off, I think, with the right way to understand Woodrow Wilson, because his Southern Democratic background was the most profound and enduring influence on his life's work, both as an academic and as a politician. I think when people think of Woodrow Wilson, if you learned about him in high school, college, or wherever, you might recall the political cartoons that featured Wilson as a schoolmaster. We Yes. always remember him as president of Princeton University and briefly as governor of New Jersey. In other words, a man from the Northeast before he became president. Right. But Wilson was, in fact, a Southerner through and through. He was born in Virginia. His family soon moved to Georgia when he was one. He lived there until he was a teenager. He and his family then moved to South Carolina, and 4 years after that, to North Carolina. He started college at Davidson in South Carolina before moving north to the College of New Jersey at last. But even then, he returned to his family home in the South for academic summers. And when he graduated from college, he made a brief but very unsuccessful attempt at law school that was also in the South at the University of Virginia. And after that, he moved back to Georgia, where he met his first, where he met his future wife. It was his first wife, but he didn't think of her as that at the time. Eventually, he started graduate school at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. And at that point, he almost became a Northerner, although technically Baltimore is just south of the Mason-Dixon line. And even in those days, as a man in his late 20s, he was moving back home with his parents in North Carolina whenever there was an academic break. So it really wasn't until he got his first paying job when he was 28 years old as a teacher at Bryn Mawr College outside of Philadelphia that he actually moved his domicile to the North. He was indeed a Southerner in his upbringing in the South, and particularly his upbringing under the influence of his father and his mother, who were, you know, pro-slavery Confederates, who stuck with those views after the war, influenced him in a number of ways.
I am a Southern Baptist, as you may know from the title, the name of the institution I lead, very much a product of the South as well. And very much a part of Southern history, just in terms of understanding, you know, my own denomination. I just had the privilege several months ago of preaching at the First Presbyterian Church of Columbia, South Carolina, which is one of the most important Presbyterian congregations in the South. And a wonderful church. I preached there many times before, but I cannot go there without walking out into the churchyard and seeing the graves of Woodrow Wilson's parents. There in the churchyard of Columbia Presbyterian, First Presbyterian Church in Columbia. And, you know, the theologian in me just has to point out that that Wilson's father, who had been pastor of the First Presbyterian Church in Augusta, had the honor of being there as well. When he was at Columbia, primarily, he was on the teaching faculty there. And quite frankly, was not an anchor of theological orthodoxy. I'll just put it that way. So, you know, Woodrow Wilson comes from a very interesting Southern background. And as a young man, he clearly has these national ambitions, but he is very much a product of his region. And Mr. Cox, I'll also submit, at least by some arguments, even into the early 20th century, much of New Jersey considered itself very apart from certainly Yankee New England. And New York. So, you know, Princeton was the southernmost of the Ivy League institutions and the one that many Southern families sent their sons to. So, you know, it wasn't a part of the South, but it was kind of an extension of the South in the view of many Southerners.
Well, in Johns Hopkins in particular,
yes.
Where Wilson had studied as a right. graduate student for a little less than 2 years, and also where he lectured, really went out of its way to recruit students from the South. Johns Hopkins was a relatively new school at the time,
Yes.
and they were trying to, make a national footprint, and they reached out across the country,
Right.
but particularly in the South. So you're absolutely right. There's quite a cocktail of influences and people from different regions, even in the Northeast, that were ultimately influences
Yes.
on Wilson himself. It's worth noting, beyond his father, Joseph Ruggles Wilson, whose grave you have visited apparently many times, Joseph Ruggles Wilson's father in Ohio was very much an abolitionist. And so his son, the future president's father, rejected his own father's teachings.
Well, you look at it, and it is absolutely fascinating. Also, from just the intersection of different issues, you have the intersection between J. Gresham Machen, who was the titanic leader of Presbyterian Orthodoxy, would eventually be at Princeton Theological Seminary as a towering figure, and then would start Westminster Theological Seminary. He and Machen, that is to say, Wilson and Machen, had a relationship that extended from their links at Johns Hopkins and then mutually at Princeton. And it was Machen who was one of the ones who noted the increasing Hegelianism in the then president of Princeton, Woodrow Wilson, who became more and more enamored of a German model of the administrative state. But Mr. Cox, he also really became much more committed to a rather Hegelian understanding of history. He saw the unfolding of the American drama as sort of a Hegelian unfolding of an inevitable progress that in his mind, and I went back to some of his earlier writings, he clearly thought he was seeing the future of kind of a Bismarckian future for the United States and its government. But you really do a great job of telling the story of how in the world he gets there, because it's not the most predictable pattern. So you include such thing as the fact that he's the only president of the United States to have a PhD, but he never wrote a PhD dissertation. And he was an ambitious young man and willing to cut just about any corner he could cut.
Yes, indeed. And that, of course, his PhD, came from Johns Hopkins, where he was a favorite of two professors there in particular, Herbert Baxter Adams and his other professor, Ely. Both were products of German universities. And they brought this German racialized view of history with them to the United States, back to their home in the United States, where they were teaching, and made a big impression on their students. Wilson being one of them, Thomas Dixon sitting next to him in those seminars being another one. The idea was that Black people were inferior, that they were not particularly worthy of study, and this bled into Wilson's later writings, when Wilson wrote a textbook called The State that was a survey of the world's governments. He organized it according to race. And in his racialized hierarchy, Aryans, that's what he called them.
Yes.
And that was a very German and European way of looking at these issues, were at the top. Below those came the Semitic peoples, who were of lesser note, lower in the evolutionary scale. And then finally we had the Turks and the Hottentots, as he called
Yes.
them, and others,
Yeah.
Who were not worthy of study whatsoever. That all started for him at Johns Hopkins. And in his book, The State, he credited his professors in the acknowledgments for that influence.
Well, one of the lamentable aspects of the Enlightenment was the fact that what we would later call eugenics really arises out of this racial hierarchialism that developed in the Enlightenment. So you have major figures from Immanuel Kant onwards who basically put together a what can only be called an explicitly racist graph of humanity. And it's really clear that Wilson bought into that in such a way that, you know, even in American historical terms, you had Theodore Roosevelt, who was a, in one sense, a Republican version of a progressivist in one limited sense. But Wilson, in so many ways, was let's just say, would have been morally and intellectually, in this sense, much more at home in the early 19th century than in the 20th century.
Yeah. So, you know, eugenics and Arianism were sort of cousins.
Right.
They had in common that they were pseudoscience, but very much thought to be the bleeding edge of scientific knowledge of the time. Arianism was really a European development, and particularly as it was documented and expanded upon by European universities, not just in Germany. There's a wonderful book called The Arian Myth that lays out this development chronologically. And of course, it became most virulent in the 1930s in Germany. We know what happened and how, you know, Arian supremacism led in its logical extension to, you know, mass slaughter and that sort of thing. But eugenics also, you know, had as one of its tenets that some people are unfit to reproduce, and
right.
You know, a lot of human rights violations that immediately follow from, you know, deciding a priori whether you're, you know, some important institution in right. society or whether the government, that certain people can or cannot marry, have children, you know, do various things, or must be castrated or what have you, you know, that was very popular as science, even among such people as Oliver Wendell Holmes.
Yes, and it ricochets through society now with you know, figures, the founder of Planned Parenthood committed a eugenicist, Margaret Sanger,
and Margaret Sanger, very much a eugenicist. Yes.
And unfortunately, that was actually tied to political progressivism as it styled itself there in the early 20th century. So lamentably, Wilson's the vector for so many of these poisons into the American system. But I want to ask you to go back to his biography for a moment, because I think you do a really good job in your book, Woodrow Wilson, The Light Withdrawn. You do a really good job of, you know, taking him through his development as a young man, to eventually getting to Princeton, although not exactly predictably. I think that's one of the interesting points. It's not a predictable trajectory. And then all of a sudden, governor of New Jersey, and then seemingly in the Democratic Party, inevitable is president of the United States. It's a story you tell very well, and I wish you'd kind of tell the story in outline, because I think it's important.
Well, as a politician, he was a supernova. You know, there hasn't been anyone faster who moved from, you know, an academic to president right. of the United States in basically the space
Not
of
a
two
tremendously
years.
Successful academic.
Well, he was president of a major university. So I think, you know, we have to have a little bit of context for deciding whether or not he was successful or not as president of Princeton, because you know, one of the things that he left as yeah. a legacy at Princeton was overt racism at a time when other Ivy League colleges, other Northeast schools right. were graduating black students. He wanted nothing to do with that. That was a little bit outre for his time. And, you know, judging him by his peers, actually, there was a study done in his last year as president of Princeton that did judge him by his peers, that compared Princeton under his leadership to other schools, the other leading schools in the United States, and found his Princeton to be the most racist and the most anti-Semitic. So those are black marks. But if you take a look at the College of New Jersey, which it was called until he was halfway through his academic tenure there, and it's relatively modest standards. It was sort of a country club of schools. When Wilson himself attended the College of New Jersey, even though he was never one of the honor men, even the people who scored more highly, you know, had a very leisurely and fun time in college. And right. You know, Wilson always considered, even when he was president of Princeton, that it was a football school. So he changed that by recruiting a lot of very important, well-known faculty and raising the standards so that people who graduated from Princeton subsequently had to meet standards that he never did. And in that sense, I think he really put Princeton on the map. But that said, you are absolutely right that he was one step ahead of the sheriff, as it were, when he got out of Princeton, because the long knives were out for him. He was in a two-year running fight with the Board of Trustees. He had lost a vote of confidence, essentially, from the majority of the board at that time, which included Grover Cleveland. So he sort of leaped out of the fire and into a whole new profession, which in his heart of hearts he'd always wanted. He always wanted to be in elected politics. And so he had a sort of a touch and go as governor of New Jersey in his first year as governor of New Jersey, which had been handed to him on a silver platter by the New Jersey bosses who were looking for a fresh face after a string of defeats by Republicans. He starts running his presidential campaign during that first year in office. And he's quite lucky at the convention that things played out the way that they did at the Democratic National Convention in Baltimore in 1912, because entering the convention, the incumbent Speaker of the House had essentially a majority of the votes in hand. And within the first few ballots, he was, this is Champ Clark now, Champ Clark is ballot after ballot after ballot, you know, winning a majority of the votes. Under the Democratic Party's rules that dated back to slavery days, where the slavery interests, you know, wanted a veto on whoever the Northerners were going to nominate, it took two-thirds. And in order to get two-thirds, they ultimately had to abandon Champ Clark. And Wilson was sort of perfectly situated as the sort of half-Southerner, half-Northerner. Yes. Northerners looked at him, they knew him, because if you were in New York, you knew the president of Princeton. Southerners said, that's one of us, and he was the perfect compromise candidate. Then, in the general election, he's essentially gifted the presidency again, because the Republicans have not one but two Republican presidents, Theodore Roosevelt and William Howard Taft, on the same ballot, fighting against each other, dividing the Republican Party, nonetheless getting a majority of the popular vote, the two Republicans. And with 42%, Wilson waltzes into the White House.
1 point less than Bill Clinton in 1992.
Yeah.
So it's a fascinating thing. So both of them would serve two terms.
Presidents.
Yeah. Yes. There's a point I want to go back to Princeton for a moment. There's a point about Wilson at Princeton that I'd like to just ask you about. You said he was just a step or two ahead of the sheriff, so to speak. You know, by the time Woodrow Wilson left Princeton, he was kind of rescued by this political career that took him to the governor's mansion in New Jersey. Virtually every constituency in the university had decided to be rid of him. And I want to make a point in this, because it comes up later in your book, and you mentioned it already, and it has to do with the fact that Woodrow Wilson comes back from Paris and refuses to give an inch to the United States Senate. Well, the reputation that he had at Princeton as an academic president was that it was his way or the highway on everything. And so even his good friends at Princeton were perplexed by the fact that he wouldn't even compromise on the things he apparently didn't care about, because he had this absolute inflexibility. And so I saw one account in terms of a history of Princeton, in which it simply says that by the time, you know, and there's a great debate, you know, Woodrow Wilson is even specific without any negotiation of exactly what kind of architecture the new graduate school has to have. And there's a man who obviously, is the favorite to lead that school. And Wilson, he's not a Wilson man, so Wilson doesn't want him, but the trustees do. I can just say, as someone who's been 30 years the president of an academic institution, you don't do well with that kind of approach. There's a difference between strong leadership and arrogant leadership.
Yes, and this was a Wilson characteristic throughout his life. We can go back even to when he first went to the college in New Jersey, and he's getting in these arguments. But this is the first time he's run into people who didn't share his views about the Civil War. And this is years after the Civil War, of course, but he's still arguing it passionately and you know, getting very angry with people and then storming out when he can't win the argument. Then subsequently, you know, we have him as president of the university, as you say, getting in these fight to the death quarrels with his dean, in this case, the dean of the graduate school, but others as well, about what should be sort of workaday issues in the administration of a university. You know, where to locate the graduate school. It was really not the kind of bigger than life issue that Wilson made it out to be.
Especially given how small Princeton's footprint was to begin with at the time.
Right. Right. And they had this beautiful, you know, site that the donor was willing to construct a building on. And surely there was an accommodation to be had there. The dean of the graduate school was left very bitter. And in one of the things that never surfaced in a Wilson biography before, I ended up quoting it in the text of my book. You know, he said that Wilson was an incorrigible liar, and he was so bitter. Now, whether, you know, his remarks and anger should be taken as probative of what Wilson really was like, that's something else. There's no question the impact that Wilson's approach to management had on this man, who was, you know, he was honored with, you know, honorary degrees. He was a well-respected Latin teacher. He raised millions of dollars, and he had been selected by the Board of Trustees to have unbridled authority over the things right. that Wilson was now interfering with. So, Wilson was very stubborn, and then that carries all the way through to the way he handled Congress, or attempted to do so, and the way he handled the Paris Peace Conference.
Well, let's get to the governor's mansion. What was his purpose in becoming the governor of New Jersey? He had this titanic ambition. He would not be governor of New Jersey for long, but no, it's an essential stepping stone on the way to the White House.
Yes, yes. So George Harvey, who runs Harper and Brothers, who published Wilson's History of the American People, a very, you know, popular book. It was designed, today we'd call it a coffee table book, or because it was multiple volumes, you know, something you put on the bookshelf to show off to people, heavily illustrated, not written for an academic audience. And it actually made Wilson a lot of money in royalties, also made a lot of money for Harper Brothers. So George Harvey, who runs this operation, is very fond of his Princeton president author, and he's, I'd say, a bourbon Democrat. Harvey is, Colonel Harvey, he went by. Several people, by the way, in this book seem to be called Colonel, even though none of them actually was, you know, commissioned as a colonel in the armed services.
It's kind of a 19th century tradition that continued into the early 20th century. So it was an honorific colonel, yes.
Yeah, sort of like Colonel Sanders. So we have George Harvey deciding that he's going to make Woodrow Wilson president. And he starts campaigning, you know, well before Wilson even thinks about running for governor of New Jersey. First, they have a plan to make him senator from New Jersey. And then they decide, you know, we've got this opening in the governorship. We can get the New Jersey bosses, who Harvey turns out to be friendly with, to, you know, give it to you on a silver platter. That's 1910. 1910 turns out to be a terrific year in New Jersey for Democrats, and was for Democrats across the country. And so Wilson can immediately go to step two of this plan, which is to campaign for president. He takes a cross-country tour, makes speeches and so on, all disclaiming that he's a candidate and so on, but introducing himself to the press and a wider public. And it all works out pretty nicely for him. The one thing that didn't work out so nicely is that this progressive, or at least newly minted progressive, because he had to abandon a lot of things that he had said while he was at Princeton, that he didn't like labor unions, he didn't like initiative and referendum and so on. So now he's adapting himself as a first-time candidate to the issues du jour, and he's a progressive, but he has a record as New Jersey governor of being very hostile to black appointees and also of standing athwart women's suffrage. So they ask him when he's governor, what do you think of this? Lots of states are debating it. Many states have already granted it. He said, no, I'm absolutely opposed. And so that's the shape that he's in when he is now a candidate for president of the United States.
So it doesn't add up to me. Yeah, I mean, you explain it in the book, but it still doesn't really add up to me. It's a progressivist era by and large. There's certainly a very strong conservative tradition, and it will reemerge, of course, in 1920. But there's this progressivist era pushing along, and yet you have this Southerner who's transplanted to the North, but he is not a progressivist in moral terms. He's not a progressivist. And I'm not using that in the same context we would use it today when we speak about progressivist ideology. I'm talking about that historical epoch. It just amazes me that someone like Woodrow Wilson could be elected in 1912. And quite honestly, could be elected when, had it been, well, let me ask you this way. Were his positions on these issues well known? Could he have been elected in 1912?
I think so. His position on women's suffrage, remember the electorate is essentially all male,
right.
Some exception, but New Jersey was certainly all male, and that's where he was running for governor. So at that, the movement for women's suffrage had reached a tipping point by then, really by the early 20th century, so even a decade before this. But
that's kind of the point I'm trying to make, yes.
But candidates, profit by distinguishing themselves from their opponents. And so there's a market at this time among men, both for women's suffrage and against it. And it was not such an overwhelming issue at that point that he was going to lose on that issue alone. And he did a very good job of staying away from the issue. So he wasn't talking about it during the campaign. You really have to look up the few times when a newspaper reporter got him and he said something, or somebody stood up at a rally and said, what about women's suffrage? But otherwise, he did not want to talk about it, and he did not make it an issue in the campaign. It was a wave election year across the state and across the country for Democrats, and he benefited from that. But mostly, remember, the bosses chose him because he was, as it were, a political cipher. It was a blank slate on which you could write almost anything. Their big problem at the time, particularly in this now robust progressive era where we're going to get rid of corruption in politics and so on, was all of the past corruption in the New Jersey Democratic Party that had cost them so many elections. And Tammany Hall has these same problems.
Absolutely.
In New York City. So here's a guy who's been in the ivory tower, and he's not really said very much about any of these issues. So he can become the perfect candidate. He's free of scandal, at least the political kind, because he hadn't been involved in politics, and he hasn't taken a position on these issues. So he can announce the positions du jour that are most popular. And for the most part, that's what Wilson did. So he was very electable in 1910.
Yeah, I guess the point I want to make, and you're such a veteran of the political process and the electoral process. The point I think is essential here is that, and you mentioned this several times, political bosses are choosing these nominees. This is not the open process, very convoluted process we have right now, but it's not a primary process. By and large, when it comes to New Jersey politics, you do have the party bosses making a decision. They're looking for, as you said, a fresh face, even at the national level in the Democratic Party in 1912. There are a few people who are contenders, but they're all basically vetted by party bosses. And Woodrow Wilson can thus go from obscurity to president of the United States because of the machinations, frankly, of a political elite.
Yeah, it's really evident on the New Jersey side, you know, when he's first getting elected governor, because literally the delegates at the Democratic State Convention in Trenton had not met him, and you know, maybe they read something about him in the newspaper, but none of them knew him. And when we think about party politics and the importance of shaking hands and looking, you know, the delegates in the eye and saying, I want your vote, and so on, none of this took place. You know, his judge and jury were, you know, a handful of these New Jersey bosses. And it was, he stayed away from the convention. He didn't come to it until after they voted for him. And then he showed up and gave a short speech. But literally, as you say, the bosses decided this.
But he did get at least a sufficient vote to be elected president in 1912. And he became president at a very crucial time. And so World War I is certainly looming on the horizon, but let's pretend we don't know that yet. And so Wilson is elected, and in domestic policies, I mean, you document in the book how astoundingly racist he was. I mean, how he basically prioritized that beyond, I think, what virtually anyone would imagine looking from the 21st century backwards.
Yes, I mean, you know, Northerners at the time, leave aside their whether they're progressives or whether they're old guard Republicans or progressive Republicans or all the different flavors of the day. These are people who, you know, by 21st standards, through the lens of presentism, we might accuse all of them of being racist because their idea of being racially progressive was, you know, let's appoint some black people here and there and that sort of thing.
Well, they often still bought into some kind of hierarchicalism, regardless of how liberal they were in the context of, say, 1912.
Right. And social equality, you know, wholly apart from voting rights or, you know, appointive office in the government or what have you, you know, that was another thing entirely. And so a lot of, you know, people who thought of themselves as progressive, they didn't quite go that far. And that's why when Teddy Roosevelt had Booker T. Washington to the White House, Woodrow Wilson protested loudly that you can't do that. Social equality, that's not a signal we want to send from the White House. And yet, you know, Teddy Roosevelt himself, you know, had his own problem with his lily white slate from the South, where he was allowing black delegates from the North, but in the South would only allow white delegates when he was the Bulmost candidate. So a lot of differences with the 21st century. But I think that's something that readers of history are accustomed to. You take off your present day hat and you look at things, you know, through the lens of the time. And the question then is, was Wilson a man of his time? And as you point out, he was much more racist than men and women of his time. The idea of instituting official segregation in the federal workforce for the first time, that was, you know, totally unnecessary, totally novel. And there was a lot of pushback from Wilson supporters. And Wilson felt very strongly that this was the way to go, and he had appointed men to his cabinet who were on board with it. At the time, it was thought that maybe this is restricted to the Treasury Department, the Postal Service, which was then the largest federal employer, and indeed the largest employer in the country, lots of patronage positions there. But in the 21st century, the National Economic Research Association has done a study of all the civil service records and found that Wilson really effectively segregated the entire federal workforce. So really quite astounding.
Well, indeed. And, looking at it in the context of our conversation today, and you put it rightly, the one question perhaps we need to focus on is, given his time, where was he? And I think you stated quite clearly he was an outlier in his time. And because he actually reversed some policies that had already been put into place, allowing more black persons to have access to federal jobs, and also in terms of even some movement in the military. But that then brings up.
Taft had what the press called his black cabinet, and there were positions that traditionally presidents had appointed black men to: ambassador to Haiti, the person we now call treasurer of the United States that signs currency, and so on. And Wilson pushed back on these things. So black men in high offices, including at the Justice Department, where Taft had appointed an assistant attorney general, lost their jobs, and new ones are not appointed. So it really was a rolling back of even the limited progress that civil rights activists of the time, such as Monroe Trotter, were frustrated with. They recognized that Republicans were appointing some black people, but not fast enough, and then they wanted to see more progress. Trotter went and visited with Wilson when he was governor, Trotter was a socialist, and so he's coming at Wilson from the left, and he wanted to take a chance on a Democrat to get some competition going to move faster on racial progress. Wilson was so assuring to him in that meeting in Trenton, in the governor's office, when he was a candidate for president, that when Trotter left, he said he was walking on air, and he supported Wilson in the 1912 campaign for president and got other black leaders to do so. And then these people are just crushed when it turns out that Wilson not only doesn't fulfill his promise of progress, but rolls everything back.
Yes. Just for the sake of time, there's so many dimensions of Woodrow Wilson and of your book I'd want to talk about. But I want to take us, let's just say, through the First World War. And I think where there's probably the greatest interest in Woodrow Wilson on the part of Americans today is in the question of the League of Nations and the failure of Wilson's ambitions there. And so I would argue that the trajectory of Wilson's leadership all the way from Princeton and beyond was in the direction of a greater integration with Europe in terms of American interests. But how does that play out? I mean, no president of the United States had for any length of time, and certainly during a congressional session, left Washington, D.C., or left the United States of America. And Wilson does so in a way that's without historical precedent and frankly should still shock us.
Yeah, it was in retrospect a very bad move for him to leave the country for what amounted to 6 months, because the country was facing terrific domestic problems at the time, terribly high inflation, recession, race riots, labor conflict, not to mention the Susan B. Anthony Amendment hanging fire, which people expected presidential help on and didn't get, or at least they didn't get it to their satisfaction. Instead, we've got the president over. I mean, just imagine today the president being gone for 6 months. That would be extraordinary and odd and make life difficult for people in Congress and others in the cabinet and governors trying to work with him. But at least today, if the president decamped to some other country for half a year, we could reach him. But not so Woodrow Wilson. Transatlantic communication at the time was almost impossible. We had, an undersea cable that, you can send Morse code on, and everything had to be encrypted at one end and decrypted at the other end. We had really infant ship-to-shore radio communication. So for these 10-day or longer voyages across the sea, the president might be out of touch altogether. But once he got to Europe, because you can't send documents or what have you back and forth, and you can't talk, he pretty much focused exclusively on what was going on in Paris and neglected everything else. So just for starters, a terrible mistake in terms of his grip on running the country. And the Senate, meanwhile, is stewing because they're not hearing anything about what he's doing over there in Paris. And that's because he broke tradition by not appointing any senators to the negotiating committee, not to mention breaking precedent by appointing himself as a negotiator, which no president had ever done, and which, you know, most people criticized. The New York Times did a survey of editorial opinion across the country, some 50 plus newspapers, and it turned out that they all opposed Wilson going to Europe for precisely the reason that domestic matters would suffer. So here he is over there in Europe and focused exclusively on, you know, his priority, the League of Nations. He originally had 14 points, and some of those stepped on the toes of Europeans who wanted to gain territory and reparations and various things. Wilson's idealistic approach to this at the outset was, we're going to have peace without victory. So we're not going to have a harsh imposed peace and so on. He ultimately caved on virtually every one of the 14 points except the League of Nations. At one point before he caved, he was so at loggerheads with the other members of the Big Four that he was going to leave for the United States on the USS George Washington. He got it all ready so that he could go. This made headlines in the United States. His White House chief of staff, called secretary at the time, telegraphed him and said, you know, you're looking petulant. Stay over there and you know, do whatever it's possible to get the League of Nations. That was the one thing to focus on, and that's what Wilson did. That was his own mind as well. Tumulty read his mind. But he ended up trading off all of the demands of the other European nations for this or that, you know, in making the settlement of the war very much like the settlement of all previous European wars. It was anything but the war to end all wars, and, you know, ultimately gave birth to World War II shortly afterward. The League of Nations, you know, as a lasting legacy for Wilson, is a little tough to credit him for, because Wilson himself destroyed, at least in America, what he set out to accomplish. It wasn't that America failed to join. The votes were there in the Senate to do that. It was that Wilson's stubbornness and refusal to make minor compromises that were urged on him by the leadership of the Democratic Party and by his closest advisors, was the reason the treaty and the League went down to defeat.
Yeah, and it's like he's back at Princeton. He can negotiate with anybody but the people he needs to negotiate with. You know, and in other words, he can't get this treaty unless the United States Senate affirms the treaty, and he will not give anything to the senators. He gives them the back of his hand, and he wouldn't even really meet with the Republican senators, who frankly had enormous power in the Senate, without whom he can't get his treaty. But he really destroys himself in the eyes of the Senate in terms of any hope for that treaty. And so by the time he leaves office, he is seen as a failed man.
Now we are skipping over an important development, because he's healthy when he comes back from Paris in 1919, but the pattern's already established of thumbing his nose at the Senate and twisting the tail of the Senate Majority Leader and the head of the Foreign Relations Committee, Henry Cabot Lodge. He goes out on an extended speaking tour to lobby the people to make the Senate change its mind. And that's his purpose. He's not negotiating with the senators. He's not taking their counsel. The advice and consent aspect is out the window. It's, as you say, my way or the highway on this one. And it's a public pressure campaign. He then breaks down in the middle of this tour, you know, super tragically. It's what makes the Wilson story a genuine Greek tragedy. You know, has to rush back, cutting off his last planned stops to Washington, and almost immediately after arriving back in D.C., suffers this terrible stroke. So after that stroke, when he's, you know, thoroughly debilitated, there's also personality change that the people around him notice. And if he was stubborn before, he's really stubborn now. He's not taking counsel from anyone. He's incorrigible. He doesn't get along with people. He's biting, snapping at people. Just a different, changed man. And that then, you know, becomes a further problem. He's so disabled that for 4 months he's kept away from anybody to see him, because if you saw him, you would realize, you know, how bad off he was. So he's now losing touch again, as he had for the half year over in Europe, with what's going on in his own country, what's going on in particular in the Senate. By March 1920, the Senate had been haggling for months on the wording of so-called mild reservations to the treaty and to the League Covenant. Reservations, I should mention, unlike amending the treaty, didn't require reopening the document for renegotiation with other countries. That had been Wilson's argument against any amendment to the treaty. But we're talking about reservations, which the Europeans had already signaled they would accept. And by March, the Senate had reached a tentative agreement. It only awaited Wilson's blessing. His press secretary, Wilson's press secretary at Versailles, Ray Baker, pleaded with Edith Wilson, who's now guarding the president and keeping the public and the senators and so on away, pleaded with her to convince the president to put aside all the trivialities and agree with the Senate on getting a league and getting it quickly. And he promised that if Wilson would just say the word, he'd have everyone with him in such a move. They were merely inconsequential changes, Baker believed. And so too did Senator Gilbert Hitchcock, who was the leader of the Senate Democrats on the treaty issue. Like everyone else, Hitchcock's urging compromise, and Wilson did just the opposite. Edith actually let Hitchcock in to see the president. Hitchcock failed to persuade Wilson. He dictated something for a letter for Hitchcock to take back to the Senate for presidential signature that urged Democrats to vote no on the treaty with any reservations. And so March 19th, I think it was, 23 Democrats who favored the treaty voted against it. Following Wilson's instructions, 35 Republicans voted for it. So it would have easily achieved the two-thirds votes it needed. Hitchcock told the president afterward it took him an extraordinary amount of effort to convince his Democratic colleagues who supported the treaty to vote against it. But that's what Wilson wanted.
An odd, odd twist in the tale. And what ends up, as you say, is a Greek tragedy. Mr. Cox, the subtitle of your book is The Light Withdrawn. To what specifically does that refer?
So that refers to a poem. The poem is called Ichabod, and it's written in the mid-19th century by an abolitionist, John Greenleaf Whittier, after whom Whittier, California is named. He had long admired Daniel Webster in the U.S. Senate for his fight against slavery. Shortly before Webster died, Webster broke faith with the abolitionists and then broke millions of American hearts in the process when he supported the fugitive slave law that was at the center of the Compromise of 1850. So Whittier, whose heart is broken along with all the other abolitionists, writes a poem. It's a mournful elegy for his former hero, who once wore glory as a crown and might have illuminated future ages. Those words seem to me especially appropriate for Woodrow Wilson, as we're coming to better understand him. Whittier's counsel in this poem is, he helps us to understand how to react to that when one of your political, someone perhaps you have lionized or you know, put on a pedestal when someone disappoints you so greatly. But what's the right response? And he says it's to repress anger and rage when someone shatters our hopes like that. And instead, those kinds of profound disappointments should be met with sadness tempered by humility. And to those of us looking on from more than a century's distance at Woodrow Wilson, that seemed to me to be especially sage advice. And so that's the little bit of that poem is quoted at the beginning of the book, and it's sort of the tenor, I hope, of the whole book. It's not presentism. We're not looking at Wilson, judging him by our standards and so on. We're looking at him, measuring him by his own time, and sharing in the disappointment that his peers felt in what he did.
Well, it is a fascinating book. I know it had to be a major investment of your life, and given your own experience, you had a very rich background from which to write the book. And I just have to conclude by saying, Mr. Cox, thank you for joining me for Thinking in Public.
Well, it's very much a pleasure to join you in a wonderful and illuminating conversation.
Many thanks to my guest, Christopher Cox, for thinking with me today. If you enjoyed today's episode of Thinking in Public, you will find more than 200 of these conversations at albertmohler.com under the tab Thinking in Public. For more information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. Thank you for joining me for Thinking in Public. Until next time, keep thinking.